fire in your eyes? If any part of you is indeed Serena Butler, then we must catch up on old times. Erasmus's optic threads gleamed. She no longer wishes to converse with you, Shiana said in her own voice. Erasmus ignored the rebuff. Take me to your private quarters. A human's den reveals much about the individual personality. I will not. The robot's voice hardened. Be reasonable. Or should I decapitate a few of your fellow passengers to encourage your cooperation? Ask Serena Butler inside you. She knows I will do it. Shiana glared at him. The robot continued in a calm tone, but a simple conversation with you in your quarters may slake my appetite for now. Wouldn't you prefer that to carnage? Motioning for the others to remain behind, Shiana turned her back on the robot and walked to one of the still functional lifts. With gliding footsteps, Erasmus followed. In her chamber, the robot was intrigued by the preserved Van Gogh painting. Cottages at Corville was one of the oldest artifacts of human civilization. Standing rigidly, Erasmus admired the artwork. Ah, yes. I remember this clearly. I painted it myself. It is the work of a 19th-century Terran artist, Vincent van Gogh. I have studied the Madman of France with great interest, but I assure you, this is actually one of the canvases I myself painted thousands of years ago. I copied the original with the utmost attention to detail. She wondered if he could possibly be telling the truth. Erasmus removed the delicate painting from the wall and examined it closely, passing his metal fingertips over the thin plaz that protected the rough oil paint surface. Yes, well do I remember each stroke, each whorl, each point of color. Truly, this is a work of genius. Shiana caught her breath, knowing how old and priceless it was. Unless it really was a forgery perpetrated long ago. The original was a work of genius. If this is what you say, then all you did was copy someone else's masterpiece. There can be only one original. His optic threads gleamed like a galaxy of stars. If it is the same, exactly the same, then both are works of genius. If my copy is perfect down to every single brushstroke, does it not become a second original? Van Gogh was a man of creativity and inspiration. You merely mimicked his work. You might as well call a face dancer a work of art. Erasmus smiled. Some of them are. Abruptly, with powerful hands, the robot ripped the painting and its frame into tiny pieces. As if putting a punctuation mark on the grotesque display, Erasmus whirled and stomped on the broken pieces, saying, "Call this artistic temperament." Moving to depart, he added, "Omnius will summon your Kwisatz Haderach soon. We have waited a long time for this." What is the difference between data and memory? I intend to find out. Erasmus, Laboratory Notebooks. The independent robot's memories of Serena were as fresh as if the events had occurred only days ago. Serena Butler. Such a fascinating woman. And just as Erasmus had survived through the millennia as a package of data nearly destroyed and then recovered, so Serena's memories and personality lived on somehow in the other memories of the Bene Gesserit. This posed an intriguing question. No Bene Gesserits could be Serena Butler's direct descendants, for Erasmus had killed her only child. Then again, he couldn't be sure what had happened to all of his experimental clones over the years. He had tried many times to bring Serena back, with no success. Aboard this no-ship, however, the humans had grown Golas from their past, just as his own plan had brought back Baron Harkonnen and a version of Paul Atreides. Erasmus knew that a null entropy tube hidden in a Tleilaxu master had contained a wealth of ancient and carefully gathered cells. He was confident that a real Tleilaxu master could succeed in bringing Serena back, where his own primitive experiments had failed. Erasmus and Omnius had both absorbed enough face dancers to have instinctive reverence for the abilities of a master. The independent robot knew exactly where he had to go before leaving the no-ship. Erasmus found the medical center and the axolotl chambers where the whole library of historical cells had been catalogued and stored. If Serena Butler was among them, he was surprised to find a Tleilaxu already there, harried and frantic. The diminutive man had disconnected the life support systems of the axolotl tanks. With his olfactory sensors, Erasmus noted the smells of chemicals, melange precursors, and human flesh. He grinned. You must be Cytale, the Tleilaxu master. It's been a long time. Cytale whirled, looking fearful at the sight of the robot. Erasmus took a step closer and studied the Tleilaxu's face. A child? What are you doing? The Tleilaxu drew himself up. I am destroying the tanks and the melange they produce. I had to surrender that knowledge as a bargaining chip. I won't let thinking machines and traitorous face dancers simply take it from me. From us. Erasmus showed no concern for the sabotaged axolotl tanks. But you appear to be very young. I am a Gola. I have my memories back. I am everything that any of my previous incarnations were. Of course you are. Such a marvelous process, perpetuating yourself through serial Gola lives. We machines understand such things, although we have much more efficient methods of performing data transfers and backups. He looked intensely at the genetic library that held the potential Gola cells. Serena Butler. Noting the robot's keen interest, the Tleilaxu sprang to stand in front of the sealed wall of specimens. Beware. The witches placed security sensors on these gene samples to prevent anyone from tampering with or stealing them. The library has a built-in self-destruct system. He narrowed his dark, rodent-like eyes. If this master was bluffing, he was doing a remarkably convincing job. I need only yank on a drawer, and this entire cabinet will be flooded with gamma radiation, enough to ionize every single sample. Why? The robot was perplexed. After the Bene Gesserit took those cells from you and used them for their own purposes, didn't they force you to cooperate? Would you truly stand on their side? He extended a platinum hand. Join us instead. I would greatly reward you for your assistance in growing one particular Gola. In a threatening motion, Cytale placed his small hand on one of the many cell containers. Though trembling, he seemed entirely determined. Yes, I would stand with them. I shall always stand against the thinking machines. Interesting. New enemies make unexpected alliances. The Tlilaxu didn't move. In the final assessment, we're all humans. And you are not. Erasmus chuckled. And what about face dancers? They fall between, don't they? These aren't the shapeshifters you produced long ago, but are instead far superior biological machines that I helped create. And because of them, Omnius and I are, in effect, the greatest of all face dancers. Among many other things. Cytale didn't move. Haven't you noticed the face dancers are no longer reliable? Ah, but they are reliable to me. Are you sure? The robot took a tentative step forward, testing. Cytale tensed his fingers on the handle of the sample cabinet. Erasmus amplified his voice. Stop! He eased himself backward, giving the Tlilaxu master more room. There would be plenty of time to return and test Cytale's loyalties. I leave you to this facility and your cellular samples. Erasmus had waited more than 15,000 years for Serena and could continue to do so. For now, the robot had to return to the machine cathedral and prepare for the final show. The Evermind was not quite so patient to achieve his ultimate goals as Erasmus was. Come, let us eat and sing together. We will share a drink and laugh at our enemies. From an Ancient Ballad by Gurney Halleck. The computer Evermind sent his troops to bring Paul from the Ithaca to the machine's cathedral-like nexus. New model robotic guards swarmed down the corridors like quicksilver insects. Approaching Paul, one of them said, "Come with us to the primary cathedral." Chaney grabbed his arm and held on, as if she too had sprouted metal hands. "I will not let you go, Usul." Looking at the inhuman escorts, he said to her, "We can't keep them from taking me." "Then I shall come with you." He tried to argue with her, but she cut him off. "I am a Fremen woman. Would you try to stop me? You might just as easily fight these machines." Concealing a small smile, he faced the sleek machines that clicked and flittered in front of him. "I will accompany you without resistance, but only if Chaney comes with me." Emerging from her quarters where Aaliyah's body now lay on the narrow bed, Jessica placed herself between Paul and the robots. Bloodstains still marked her ship suit. "He is my son. I have already lost a daughter today and cannot bear to lose him as well. I'm going with you." "We are here to escort Paul Atreides to the primary cathedral," one of the robots said, its free-form face flowing like heavy rain on a Caladan window. "There are no other restrictions." Paul took that as agreement. For some reason, Omnius wanted him, even though he did not have his memories back. All other passengers and crew were apparently extraneous baggage. Had he been the subject of the hunt from the beginning? How could that be? Had the thinking machines somehow known he would be aboard? Paul gripped Chaney's hand and said to her, "It will be over soon, in whatever manner fate decides. All along, our destinies have hurtled us toward this point. Like levitating trains out of control." "We will face it together, my love," Chaney said. He only wished that he could recall all his years with her, and that she could do the same. What about Duncan? He asked. And Shiana? We must depart now, the robots said in unison. Omnius waits. Duncan and Shiana will know soon enough, Jessica said. Before they left, Paul made a point of taking the kris knife Chaney had made for him. Like a Fremen warrior, he wore it proudly at his waist. Although the worm-tooth blade would do nothing against the thinking machines, it made him feel more like the legendary Muad'Dib, the man who defeated powerful empires. But in his mind, he again saw the horrible recurring vision, the flicker of memory or prescience in which he lay on the floor in a strange place, mortally wounded, looking up at a younger version of himself who laughed in triumph. He blinked and sought to focus on reality, not possibilities or destiny. Following the insectile robots down the corridors, he tried to tell himself he was prepared to face whatever lay in store for him. Before the Golas could emerge from the ship through the ragged hole the machines had made, Wellington Yue tried to push his way past the ranks of escort robots. Wait! I need to go with you! He fumbled for excuses. If someone gets hurt, I'm the best soup doctor available. I can help. He lowered his voice and pleaded, The Baron will be there, and he'll want to see me. Still wrestling with her re-injured feelings toward him, Jessica sounded harsh and bitter. Help. Did you help Aaliyah? Hearing this, Yue looked as if she had slapped him. Let him come, Mother. Paul felt resigned. Dr. Yue was a staunch childhood supporter and mentor to the original Paul. I won't turn down any ally or witness to whatever is about to occur. Following the robots, they emerged onto flowing roadways that carried them along like floating plates. Bat-like flyers streaked high overhead, and mirrored watch-eyes flitted about in the air, observing the group's progress from all angles. Behind them, the huge no-ship had been incorporated into the machine metropolis. Sentient metal buildings of free-form architecture had grown around the Ithaca's hull like coral swallowing up an old shipwreck beneath the seas of Caladan. The buildings seemed to alter whenever the Evermind had a fleeting thought. This whole city is alive and thinking, Paul said. It's all one changeable, adapting machine. Under her breath, his mother quoted, Thou shalt not create a machine in the likeness of the human mind. Speakers appeared in the solid silver walls of the looming buildings, and a simulated voice mockingly repeated Jessica's words. Thou shalt not create a machine in the likeness of the human mind. What a quaint superstition! The laughter sounded as if it had been recorded from somewhere else, distorted freakishly, and then played back. I look forward to our encounter. The escort robots brought them into an enormous structure with shimmering walls, curved arches, and enclosed park-like spaces. A spectacular lava fountain spouted plumes of hot, scarlet liquid into a tempered basin. In the middle of the great cathedral hall, an elderly man and woman awaited them, dressed in loose, comfortable garments. Dwarfed by the enclosure, they certainly did not look menacing. Paul decided not to wait for their captors to play control games. Why have you brought me here? What do you want? I want to help the universe. The old man stepped down the polished stone stairs. We are in the end game of Kralizek. A watershed that will change the universe forever. Everything that came before will end, and everything that comes in the future will be under my guidance. the old woman explained. Consider all the chaos that has existed over the millennia of your human civilization. Such messy creatures you are. We thinking machines could have done a much neater, more efficient job. We have learned of your God Emperor Leto II, and the scattering, and the famine times. At least he enforced peace for 3,500 years, the old man added. He had the right idea. My grandson, Jessica said. They called him tyrant because of the difficult decisions he made. But even he did not do as much damage as your thinking machines did during the Butlerian Jihad. You cast blame too loosely. Did we cause the damage and destruction, or did humans like Serena Butler? That is a matter for debate. Abruptly, the old woman cast off her disguise, like a reptile shedding its dry skin. The robot's flow metal face, male now, displayed a wide smile. From the beginning, machines and humans have been at odds. But only we are able to observe the long span of history, and only we can understand what must be done and find a logical way to achieve it. Is that not a valid analysis of your legendary Kralizek? Only an interpretation, Jessica said. The correct one, though. Right now, we are involved in the necessary business of uprooting weeds in a garden. An apt metaphor. The weeds themselves do not appreciate it, and the dirt may be disturbed for some time, but in the end, the garden is vastly improved. Machines and humans are but manifestations of a long-standing conflict that your ancient philosophers recorded. The battle between heart and mind. Omnius retained his old man form, since he had no other familiar physical manifestation. Back in the old empire, many of your people are trying to make their last stands against us. It is futile, for my face dancers have ensured that your weapons will not work. Even your navigation machines are under my control. Already my fleet approaches Chapter House. Our ship has had no contact with either the Guild or Chapter House since before I was born, Paul said in a dismissive tone. He pointed to Chaney, Jessica, and Yui, all of those Golas born on the ship in flight. None of us has ever been in the old empire. Then allow me to show you. With a wave of his hand, the old man displayed a complex holo image of stars, indicating how far his immense fleet had progressed. Paul was stunned by the scope of the conquest and devastation. He didn't think the Evermind would exaggerate what the machines had done. Omnius didn't need to. Hundreds of planets had already been destroyed or enslaved. In a soothing voice, Erasmus said, "Fortunately, the war will soon be over." The old man approached Paul. "And now that I have you, there is no question of the outcome. The mathematical projection states that the Kwisatz Haderach will change the battle at the end of the universe. Since I control you and the other one, we will now finish this conflict." Erasmus stepped forward to inspect Paul like a scientist examining a valuable specimen. His optic threads glittered. "We know you have the potential within your genes. The challenge lies in determining which Paul Atreides will be the better Kwisatz Haderach." Optimism may be the greatest weapon humanity possesses. Without it, we would never attempt the impossible, which, against all odds, occasionally succeeds. Mother Commander Mirbella, speech to the gathered sisterhood. Without obliterators or navigation control, the human warships lay like white-bellied victims on sacrificial altars, all across the last stand line they had drawn. Aboard her flagship, Mother Commander Mirbella shouted orders, while Guild Administrator Goris demanded miracles from his underlings. Watching the screens on the navigation bridge, Mirbella saw thinking machine battleships cruise past the Sisterhood's pitiful vessels on their way to destroy Chapter House. Similar non-battles must be occurring at the 100 flashpoints across the front lines, key human-inhabited systems now completely vulnerable to the coup de grace. The gamble had failed utterly. Weighing heavily on Mirbella's mind was her responsibility to humanity, the rest of the Sisterhood, and her long-lost Duncan. Was he still alive? And did he even remember her? It had been almost 25 years. Mirbella had to do this. For him, for herself, or for all those who had survived thus far in the epic war. Without letting instinctive Honored Matre rage control her actions, Mirbella whirled toward Goris. She grabbed the front of the administrator's loose robe and shook him so that his pale braid whipped his face. What other weapons do your guild ships have? A few projectiles, Mother Commander. Energy weapons. Standard offensive artillery. But that would be suicide. Only the obliterators could have made it possible for our ships to deal a mortal blow against the enemy. In disgust, she cast him away so that he stumbled backward and fell to the deck. This is already a suicide mission. How dare you cringe now when we have no alternative? But Mother Commander, it would waste our fleet, our lives. Obviously, heroism is not your strong suit. She turned to a meek-looking guildsman and used the power of Bene Gesserit voice on him for good measure. Prepare to launch our obliterators. Blanket space with them. Maybe the saboteurs missed a few. The guildsman operated his weapons controls, barely bothering to choose targets. He launched 10 more obliterators, then another 10. None exploded, and the machine ships kept coming. Her voice low, Mirbella said, Now fire all the standard projectiles we have. And once we deplete our conventional armaments, we'll use our ships as battering rams. Whatever we have. But why, Mother Commander? Goris said. We should fall back and regroup. Plan some other way to fight. We must at least survive. If we don't win today, we don't survive anyway. We may be outnumbered, but we can still wipe out part of the thinking machine fleet. I will not simply abandon Chapter House. Goris scrambled back to his feet. To what purpose, Mother Commander? The machines can just replace themselves. As they spoke, more obliterators filled space. So far, all had turned out to be duds. The purpose is to show them we can still fight. It is what makes us human, what gives us significance. History shall not record that we abandoned Chapter House and tried to hide from the final confrontation between humanity and the thinking machines. History? Who will be left to record history? Within 3 minutes of each other, 6 small fold spacecraft raced into the battle zone over Chapter House, reporting from the other clusters of ships. They transmitted urgent messages and demanded new orders from the Mother Commander. Our obliterators don't function. All navigation systems have shut down. How do we fight them now, Mother Commander? She answered in a strong, steady tone. We fight with everything we have. Just then, a fabulously bright flash blew across at least 50 of the enemy vessels, vaporizing them in an expanding arc that sent a shudder through the decks of the more distant guild vessels. Mirbella gasped, then laughed. See? One of the obliterators still worked. Fire the rest of them! To her astonishment, space around them suddenly shimmered, cracked, and disgorged hundreds of giant ships. Not human defender vessels. At first, Mirbella thought that the enemy machines had sent yet another devastating fleet, but she quickly identified the cartouche on the curved hulls. Guild Highliners. They spilled out of fold space from every direction, surrounding the first massive wave of thinking machine vessels. Administrator, why did you hold out on us? Mirbella's voice was brittle. There must be 1,000 ships here. Goris seemed just as astonished as she was. A female voice thrummed across the comm lines that linked Mirbella's defenders. I am the Oracle of Time, and I bring reinforcements. Mathematical compilers corrupted many guild vessels, but my navigators control these highliners. Navigators? The white-haired administrator gasped in consternation. We thought they were all dead. Starved for spice. The Oracle spoke in a powerful, lilting tone. And my ships, unlike those made by the traitorous fabricators of Ix, command full armaments. Our obliterators work as designed. We took them from old honored Matre ships and hid them away for our own defenses. We intend to use them now. Mirbella's face flushed. She had suspected the rebel-honored Matres had possessed many more obliterators than were found. So, the navigators had been hiding them all along. The ominous invasion fleet shifted position in response to the navigator reinforcements, but the machines could not comprehend the magnitude of the astonishing opponent they now faced. They did not react in time as the Oracle's highliners spewed out dazzling sunbursts in a flurry of explosions like miniature supernovas. Each incinerating burst of light vaporized entire clusters of the overly complacent enemy vessels. Although the machine forces scrambled to defend themselves, their response was ineffective, as if their control functions had been disconnected. The Evermind had modeled his plan repeatedly, setting up contingency options for likely turns of events. But Omnius had not foreseen this. Thinking machines have long been my sworn enemies, the Oracle said in her ethereal voice. While Mirbella looked on with great satisfaction, precisely targeted obliterators wiped out countless enemy ships. If only the honored Matres had simply turned their stolen weapons against the thinking machines when they'd had the chance long ago. But those women had never stood together against a common foe. Instead, they hoarded their stolen weapons and used the destructive power against each other, against rival planets. What a waste. The overlapping detonations, each strong enough to scorch a planet, struck the front line of machine ships. 12 Highliners raced deeper into the Chapter House system to chase enemy vessels that had already reached planetary orbit. We will do what we can at your other frontline planets, the Oracle said. Today, we hurt the enemy. Almost before she could absorb what was happening around her, Mirbella saw that the initial wave of thinking machine forces had been reduced to nothing more than scattered debris. As far as she could tell, the enemy battleships never got the chance to launch a single shot against the defenders of humanity. Some of the highliners winked out, folding space to go to the other crippled last-stand defenders. There, they would deliver their obliterators and speed off to further encounters with the enemy. All across the front lines, at every flashpoint where Mirbella had placed her groups of fighters, the Oracle's navigators struck and vanished again. Mirbella snapped to Administrator Goris. Get me a comm channel. How do we talk to your Oracle of Time? Goris was stunned by the events around him. One does not request an audience with the Oracle. No living person has ever initiated contact with her. She just saved our lives. Let me talk with her. With a skeptical expression, the administrator made a gesture toward another guildsman. We can try, but I promise nothing. The gray-robed man fiddled with the comm line until Mirbella shouldered him aside. Oracle of Time, whoever you are, let us join forces to eradicate the thinking machines. A long silence was Mirbella's only response, not even static, and her heart sank. Goris gave her a superior look, as if he had known to expect this all along. Mirbella saw a second wave of thinking machine ships race in, now that the initial attack had been thwarted. And these would not tauntingly hold their fire. More machines are coming. For now, I must move on. As the Oracle spoke, highliners began to disappear like soap bubbles popping. My main battle is on synchrony. Wait, Mirbella cried. We need you. We are needed elsewhere. Kralizek will not be consummated here. At long last, I have found the no-ship that carries Duncan, Idaho, and the secret location of Omnius. I must now go there to end this by destroying the Evermind. Forever. Mirbella reeled as the unexpected information hit her. The no-ship found? Duncan was alive. Within moments, the last of the highliners vanished into fold space, leaving the Mother Commander and her ships alone to face the next wave. The thinking machines kept coming. We have our own goals and ambitions, for good or ill. But our true destiny is decided by forces over which we have no control. The Atreides Manifesto, First Draft, section deleted by Bene Gesserit Committee. A door in the machine's grand cathedral flowed open like a waterfall of metal, parting to reveal two figures that stepped forward in tandem. It had been hours since Baron Vladimir Harkonnen had murdered Aaliyah, yet his wide lips still struggled to contain his satisfaction. His spider-black eyes glinted. Dr. Yui glared at the Baron, his personal bête noire. Paul did not need Golem memories to recognize the Baron's companion. A lean young man, barely more than a boy, but whipcord strong with muscles tuned from constant training. The eyes were harder, the features sharper, but Paul knew the face that stared back at him from the mirror. Beside him, Chaney gave a strangled cry, but the sound changed to a growl in her throat. She recognized the younger Paul, and also saw the terrible difference. A cold sense of inexorability froze Paul's blood as everything became clear. his prescient vision in the flesh. So, the thinking machines had grown another gola of Paul Atreides to be their pawn, a second potential Kwisatz Haderach for their private use. Now he understood the recurring dreams of his own face, laughing triumphantly, consuming spice, the peculiar image of himself, stabbed and dying, bleeding out his life's blood on a strange floor, just like the one on which he stood now, in this vaulted chamber. It will be one of us. It seems we have an abundance of Atreides. The Baron ushered his protege forward, his hand clamped on the young man's shoulder. Almost apologetically, as if the wary audience cared, he said, "We call this one Paolo." Paolo pulled away from him. "Before long you will call me Emperor, or Kwisatz Haderach. Whichever term grants me the highest respect." Looking on, the old man and Erasmus seemed to find the whole tableau amusing. Paul wondered how many times he had been trapped by fate, by terrible purpose. How often and in how many circumstances had he seen himself dead from a knife thrust? Now he cursed the fact that he would face this crisis as a shell of his former self, not armed with the memories and skills of his past. "Unto myself, I must be sufficient." Snickering, the younger boy walked to where his counterpart stood stiffly at attention. Paul looked back at his mirror image without fear. Despite the age difference, they were approximately the same height, and as Paul looked into his doppelganger's eyes, he knew he must not underestimate this Paolo. The youth was a weapon as sure and deadly as the kris knife at Paul's waist. Jessica and Chaney moved protectively close to Paul, ready to strike. His mother, with her memories restored, was a full reverend mother. Chaney, though she did not yet have her past life, had shown considerable fighting skills in earlier practice sessions, as if she still felt Fremen blood in her veins. Paolo's brow furrowed, his expression flickering for just a moment. Then he sneered at Jessica. "Are you supposed to be my mother? The Lady Jessica? Well, you may be older than I am, but that doesn't make you a real mother." Jessica gave him a brief, shrewd appraisal. "I know my family, regardless of the order in which they were reborn, and you are not one of them." Paolo crossed the chamber floor toward Chaney, leering with exaggerated hauteur. "And you? I know you, too. You were supposed to be the great love of my life. A Fremen girl so insignificant that history recorded little of her youth. Daughter of Liet Kynes, weren't you? A complete nobody until you became the consort of the great Muad'Dib." Paul could feel her nails digging into his arm as she ignored the boy and talked to him instead. "The Bashar's teachings were right, Usul. A gola's worth is not intrinsic in its cells. The process can go horribly wrong, as it clearly did with this young monster." "It's more a matter of parenting," the Baron said. "Imagine how the universe would be changed if the original Muad'Dib had received different instructions in the uses of power. If I had raised him, as I tried to do with the lovely boy Faedrautha." "Enough of this," Omnius broke in. "My machine battleships are even now clashing with, or should I say annihilating, the pathetic remnants of human defenses. According to my last reports, the humans were making simultaneous stands across space. That will allow me to destroy them all at once and be done with it. Erasmus nodded to the humans in the cathedral chamber. Within a few more centuries, your own warring factions would have torn your race apart anyway. The old man shot the independent robot an annoyed look. Now that I have the final Kwisatz Haderach here, all the conditions have been fulfilled. It is time to end this. There is no need to bother with grinding every inhabited world to dust. His lips quirked in a strange smile. Though that would be enjoyable as well. Musing, Erasmus looked from Paul to Paolo. Although genetically identical, you two have slightly different ages, memories, and experiences. Our Paolo is technically a clone, grown from blood cells preserved on a dagger. But this other Paul Atreides, what is the origin of your cells? Where did the Tliloxu find them? I don't know, Paul said. According to Duncan, the elderly man and woman had begun their merciless pursuit well before anyone had suggested the Gola Project, before old Cytale revealed his null entropy capsule. How could the Evermind have known that Paul would reappear here? Had the machines rigged a complex game? Had the sentient machines developed an artificial but sophisticated form of prescience? Erasmus made a humming sound. Even so, I believe you each have the potential to be the Kwisatz Haderach we need. But which of you will prove superior and achieve it? It's me. Paolo strutted around. We all know that. Obviously, the younger boy had been raised with a belief in his role, so that his head was filled with confidence, though it was a confidence born of true skill, not one arising from imagination. And how will that be determined? Jessica asked, looking at both Pauls, weighing them with her eyes. A side door flowed open near the fountain that sprayed molten metal, and a man in a black one-piece suit emerged carrying an ornate bloodwood box topped with a smaller wrapped package. He was gaunt, with bland features. Crone, there you are. We have been waiting. I am here, Lord Omnius. The man glanced at the assemblage, and then, either in surrender or a flash of independence, his unremarkable human features faded away to reveal him as a pale and sunken-eyed face dancer. Setting the box aside, he carefully unwrapped the translucent fabric of the small package to reveal a brownish-blue paste flecked with gold spangles. This is a concentrated and unusually potent form of spice. The face dancer rubbed his fingertips and lifted them to his inhuman nose, as if the smell pleased him. Harvested from a modified worm that grows in the oceans of Boozle. It will not be long before the witches understand and begin their own operations there to capture the worms and extract the spice. At the moment, though, I hold the only sample of this ultra spice. Its sheer power should be sufficient to plunge the Kwisatz Haderach, one of you, into a perfect prescient trance. You will achieve powers that only prophecy could predict. You will see everything, know everything, and become the key to the culmination of Kralizek. Erasmus spoke, sounding almost cheery. After observing how the human race has ruined things without us around to maintain order, the universe definitely needs changing. The robot picked up the bloodwood box and raised the finely etched lid. Inside lay an ornate, gold-hilted dagger, which he picked up with something like reverence. A smear of old blood remained on the blade. Behind Paul, his mother gasped. "I know that dagger. It's as clear and fresh in my mind as if I just saw it. Emperor Shaddam himself presented it to Duke Leto as a gift, and years later at Shaddam's trial, Leto gave it back to him." "Oh, there is more than that." The Baron's eyes glittered. "I believe the Emperor gave that same dagger to my beloved nephew Fade Rautha for his duel with your son. Unfortunately, Fade didn't quite succeed in that battle." "I love convoluted stories," Erasmus added. "Later still, Hasmir Fenring stabbed Emperor Muad'Dib with it and nearly killed him. So you see, this dagger has a long and checkered past." He lifted it, letting the light of the cathedral chamber gleam off the blade. "The perfect weapon to help us make our choice, don't you think?" Paul drew the kris-knife Chaney had made for him from its sheath at his side. The hilt felt warm in his grip, the curved, milky blade perfectly balanced. "I have my own weapon." Paolo danced back warily, looking at the Baron, Omnius, and Erasmus, as if expecting them to leap to his aid. He snatched the gold-hilted dagger from the robot's hand and pointed the sharp tip at Paul. "And what are they to do with these weapons?" Jessica asked, though the answer was obvious to everyone. The robot looked at her in surprise. "It is only appropriate that we solve this problem in a particularly human way. A duel to the death, of course. Is that not perfect?" "The worm is outside for all to see, and the worm is within me, part of me. Beware, for I am the worm. Beware!" Leto II, Dar Es Balat Recordings, in his voice. After Paul and his companions were taken from the no-ship, Shiana found young Leto II in his quarters. Huddling all alone in the dark, the youth was feverish and trembling. At first she thought he was terrified at having been left behind, but she soon realized he was genuinely sick. Seeing her, the boy forced himself to his feet. He swayed, and perspiration glistened on his brow. He looked pleadingly at her.
"Reverend Mother Shiana, you're the only one. The only one who knows the worms."
His large, dark eyes flicked from side to side.
"Can you hear them?" "I can."
She frowned.
"Hear them? I don't... The sandworms. The worms in the hold. They're calling me, tunneling through my mind, tearing me up inside."
Raising her hand for silence, she paused, deep in thought. All her life, Shaitan had understood her, but she had never received any actual messages from the creatures, even when she'd tried to become part of them. But now, by extending her senses, she did feel a tumultuous thrumming in her head and through the walls of the damaged no-ship. Since the Ithaca's capture, Shiana had ascribed such feelings to the crushing weight of failure after their long flight. But now she began to understand. Something had been scraping through her subconscious, like dull fingernails raking across the slate of her fear. Subsonic pulses of invitation. The sandworms. "We have to go to the hold,"
Leto announced. They are calling. I know what to do. Shiana gripped the boy's shoulders. What is it? What do we have to do? He pointed to himself. Something of me is inside the worms. Shai Hulud is calling. With the no-ship safely trapped in living metal constructions, the thinking machines paid little attention to the vessel. Apparently, they had wanted to own and control the Kwisatz Haderach, a goal that was not as simple as it sounded, as the Sisterhood had learned long ago. Now that he had Paul Atreides in his machine cathedral, Omnia seemed to think he possessed everything he needed. The remaining passengers were irrelevant prisoners of war. The Bene Gesserits had planned the creation of their Superman over hundreds of generations, subtly guiding bloodlines and breeding maps to produce the long-anticipated Messiah. But after Paul Muad'Dib turned against them and created havoc in their carefully ordered timeline, the sisters had vowed never to unleash another Kwisatz Haderach. But in the long-ago aftermath, Muad'Dib's twin children had been born before the damage could be fully understood. One of those twins, Leto II, had been a Kwisatz Haderach, like his father. A key turned in Shiana's mind, unlocking other thoughts. Perhaps in the solemn 12-year-old Leto, the thinking machines had a blind spot. Could he be the final Kwisatz Haderach they sought? Had Omnius even considered the possibility that the machines might have the wrong one? Her pulse quickened. Prophecies were notorious for misdirection. Maybe Erasmus had missed the obvious. She could hear the inner voice of Serena Butler laughing at the possibility, and she allowed herself to cling to a tiny kernel of hope. Let's go to the cargo hold, then. Shiana took the boy's hand, and they hurried down the corridors and drop chutes to the lower levels. As they approached the great doors, Shiana heard explosive thunder from the other side. The frenzied worms charged from one end of the kilometer-long space to the other, smashing into the walls. By the time they arrived at the access door, young Leto seemed ready to collapse.
We have to go in, he said, his face flushed. The worms. I need to talk with them.
Calm them. Shiana, who had never been afraid of the sandworms before, now hesitated, worried that in their wild state they might not grant safety to her or Leto. But the boy worked the controls, and the sealed door slid aside. Hot, dry air blew onto their faces. Leto waded out and up to his knees in the soft dunes, and Shiana hurried after him. When Leto raised his arms and shouted, all seven worms charged toward him like snorting predators, with the largest one, Monarch, at the fore. Shiana could feel the hot wave of their anger, their need for destruction, but something told her that rage was not directed at either of them. The creatures rose up from the sand and towered over the two humans. The thinking machines are outside the ship, Shiana said to Leto. Will they fight for us? The boy looked forlorn. They will follow my path if I lay it out for them. But I can't see it yet myself. Looking at him, she wondered again if this boy could be the ultimate Kwisatz Haderach, the link in the chain that Omnius had overlooked. What if Paul Atreides was no more than a feint in the final duel between man and machine? Leto shook himself, visibly bolstering his determination. But the prior me, the God Emperor, had tremendous prescience. Maybe he foresaw this as well and prepared the beasts. I trust them. At this, The worms dipped in unison, as if bowing. Leto swayed, and they swayed with him. For a moment the walls of the hold seemed to recede, and the sand dunes flowed out to eternity. The ceiling disappeared in a vertiginous haze of dust. Suddenly, everything snapped back into focus. Leto caught his breath and called out, "The Golden Path is coming to meet me. It is time to release the worms. Here and now." Shiana sensed the rightness of this and knew what to do. All systems were still programmed to obey her instructions. "The machines deactivated the weapons and engines, but I can still open the great cargo doors." She and Leto hurried to the controls in the hall, where she input the commands. Machinery hummed and strained. Then, with a loud clank and a bang, a gap appeared in the long, sealed walls. From the corridor, Shiana and the boy watched the immense lower doors slide open, like clenched teeth being pried apart. Tons of sand spilled out in a rushing stream and propelled the sandworms, like living battering rams, into the streets of the machine capital. Prescience reveals no absolutes, only possibilities. The surest way to know exactly what the future holds is to experience it in real time. Conversations with Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. A duel makes no sense. The Baron frowned as he looked around the cathedral chamber. It is wasteful. Naturally, I am convinced my dear Paolo will defeat this upstart, but why not keep both Kwisatz Haderachs for yourself, Omnius? I desire only the best one, the Evermind said. And we could not be certain of controlling two of them as they struggled for preeminence with their new powers, Erasmus said. Whichever of you wins the duel will receive the Ultra Spice, Omnius announced. When the winner consumes it, I will have my true and final Kwisatz Haderach. I can then conclude this wasteful nonsense and begin my real work of remaking the universe. Chaney kept one hand on Paul's arm. How do you know either of them is your Kwisatz Haderach? You could be delusional, Yui said, and the boy Paolo shot him a glare. And why should I cooperate if I win? Paul said, but the sickening echoes of recurring visions strangled his protest. He thought he knew what was going to happen, or some piece of it. Because we have faith. The Baron, a paragon of unholiness, laughed at his own joke, but no one else did. Paolo drew designs in the air with the tip of his gold-hilted knife. I have the Emperor's dagger. You were stabbed with it once. That won't happen again. This is my day of triumph. But Paul heard the brittleness in his measured words, the vulnerability behind the bravado. He could see no way to avoid the duel and wasn't sure he wanted to. In his mind, he drove back the troubling flashes of vision. This perverse version of himself needed to be cut out like a cancer. The time had come. Paul gathered all of his concentration for the fight. Hardly seeing Chaney, he kissed her. The worm-tooth dagger she had made felt perfectly balanced in his hand. He had practiced with the Kris knife on the no-ship, and he knew how to fight. I must not fear. Fear is the mind-killer. Young Paolo pressed his lips together in a tight smile. I can tell you've had the visions, too. See? We are alike in yet another aspect. I've had many visions. I will face my fear. Not like these. His opponent's knowing smile was maddening, unnerving. Paul stiffened his resolve. He would not give Paolo the satisfaction of showing dread or uncertainty. Quicksilver robots appeared and removed the human observers to the sidelines of the expansive hall. The Baron stepped back beside Crone, his gaze flicking back and forth between young Paolo and the tempting dose of Ultra Spice. He licked his thick lips hungrily, as if wishing he could try some for himself. On the smooth combat floor of the chamber, Paul stood poised a couple of meters from Paolo. His younger foe tossed the gold-hilted dagger from hand to hand and smiled at him, showing white teeth. Calming himself, Paul summoned all the important lessons he had learned. Bene Gesserit attitudes and Prana Bindu instruction, the precise muscular training and rigorous attack exercises that Duncan and the Bashar had drilled into all of the Gola children. He spoke to his fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. It would all culminate here. Paul felt confident that if he rose to the challenge and won, his Kwisatz Haderach powers would surface, and he would be able to go on to defeat the thinking machines. But if Paolo won, he didn't want to consider that possibility.
Usul, remember your time among the Fremen, Chaney called from the side of the hall. Remember how they taught you to fight.
He remembers none of it, bitch. Paolo slashed the Emperor's knife across the air, as if slitting an invisible throat. But I am fully trained, a tempered fighting machine. The Baron applauded, but only a little. No one likes a braggart, Paolo. Unless, of course, you succeed and prove to everyone that you were merely stating facts. Paul refused to be controlled by his visions. If I am the Kwisatz Haderach, I'll change the visions. I shall fight. I shall be everywhere at once. Young Paolo must have been thinking the same thing, for he lunged like a viper. Startled by the abrupt beginning of the duel, Erasmus swept his plush robes aside and stepped quickly out of the way. Apparently, he had intended to delineate the rules of the challenge, but Paolo wanted to make it a brawl. Paul bent backward like a reed and let the Emperor's blade whistle past, within a centimeter of his neck. Young Paolo snickered. That was just practice. He held up the dagger, showing the rust-red stains. I am one step ahead of you, for this knife is already blooded. It's more your blood than mine, Paul said under his breath. He drove forward with the kris knife, weaving, making the blade dance. The younger Gola responded by mirroring Paul's movements, as if the pair had an unconscious telepathic connection. He stabbed to the side, and Paul flowed in the other direction. Was this a form of prescience, Paul wondered, subconsciously foreseeing each blow, or did the two of them know and reproduce each other's fighting styles exactly? They had entirely different training, entirely different upbringings. But still, concentrating on the duel, Paul's hearing became a fuzz of static. At first he heard encouragement, gasps, shouts of concern from his mother and Chaney, but he blocked everything out. Did he have the potential to become the ultimate Kwisatz Haderach that Omnius was searching for? Did he want to be? He had read the histories, knew the bloodshed and suffering that Paul Muad'Dib and Leto II had both caused as Kwisatz Haderachs. What would the machines try to accomplish by possessing an even stronger Kwisatz Haderach? Some locked away part of Paul already had the ability to look where no one else could. into both feminine and masculine pasts. What other powers lie untapped within me? Do I dare find out? If I win this duel, what will the thinking machines demand of me afterward? He felt like a gladiator on ancient Terra having to prove himself in an arena, and he had a fatal weakness. Omnius held Chaney, Jessica, Duncan, and so many others as hostages. If Paul got his Gola memories back, his feelings for them would be even stronger. Obviously, that was how Omnius intended to force Paul to cooperate if he won this duel. His love for his companions would only intensify, and they would suffer because of him. Since the computer Evermind had far more patience than any human, the machines could torture and kill these hostages with impunity, take cell scrapings and grow new Golas. Over and over. Perhaps Erasmus would bring back his sister Aaliyah, his father the Duke, or Gurney, or Thufir. Kill them, resurrect them, and kill them again. Unless Paul Atreides, the Kwisatz Haderach, bowed to their demands, the thinking machines would make his life an unending hell. Or so they intended. Now he understood the dilemma of his destiny, and again he saw himself dying in a pool of blood. Perhaps some things could not be changed. But if he was a true Kwisatz Haderach, he should be able to defeat such petty tactics. He fought on with wild passion, driving himself into a sweaty frenzy. Paolo kicked at him with his feet and slashed with the Emperor's dagger. Paul dove, rolled, and the younger Gola pounced on him. The Emperor's blade drove down hard in what would have been a killing thrust, but Paul slipped to the side, barely in time. The blade slashed his sleeve, cut a thin line of blood on his left shoulder, then clanged against the stone floor. Paolo, his wrist jolted by the sharp impact, barely maintained a grip on the hilt. On the polished floor, Paul swept his feet sideways, getting them under his rival and kicking upward. He did have the advantage of being physically stronger than a 12-year-old. Paul grabbed his counterpart's wrist and pulled himself to his feet, but Paolo locked his fingers around Paul's knife arm, preventing the Chris knife from stabbing down. Paul pushed, using his leverage to maneuver them both back toward the shimmering lava fountain.
Not very innovative.
The younger Gola's breath rasped as he struggled, and Paul continued to drive him back. The heat from the fountain gushed in all directions. If he knocked Paolo into the incandescent metal, would he be killing himself or saving himself? Paul saw his opponent clearly and could not hate the other Gola. At the core, both of them were Paul Atreides. Paolo was not innately evil, but had been corrupted by terrible things that had been done to him, things he had been taught, not things done of his own volition. Paul did not let his sympathy for his rival weaken him. If he did, Paolo would not hesitate to kill him and claim victory. But Paul, because he was Paul, would fight with every ounce of his being to save the future of humanity. Omnius and Erasmus observed without cheering for either fighter. They would accept whichever one proved victorious. Crones shadowed, olive pit eyes held no emotion at all. The Baron was scowling. Paul didn't want to look toward Chaney or his mother. The roaring lava fountain dumped heat into the air. Paul's already sweaty body became slicker. Wiry Paolo used that to his advantage, squirmed, and Paul's grip began to slip. Suddenly, at the very verge of the fountain, the younger man allowed his knees to buckle. Paul overcompensated, which threw him off balance. He kneed his opponent in the stomach, but young Paolo had untapped reserves. When Paul raised the kris knife in his sweat-slickened grip, Paolo brought his own hand up backward, using the jeweled hilt of his dagger to smash the base of Paul's knife hand. Tendons twitched in reflexive reaction. The kris knife dropped free, clattered on the edge of the fountain, and tumbled into the molten pool.